The Protect Your Neck Podcast, UFC Kansas City Breakdown Show. From mice, alligators, thugs to heathens, we'll find out what's worth believing.
Hot air hangs like a dead man from a white oak tree. People sitting on porches thinking how things used to be. Dark night. It's a dark night. Dark.
What is up, my fellow degenerates and degenerites alike, or as I like to say, my friends. This is the Protect Your Neck Podcast, and I am your host, Dan Tom, analyst and writer for FlowCombat.com. And today, tonight, or this morning, depending on when you're listening, we are going to be breaking down, yes, UFC Kansas City, or UFC on Fox 24, to be more precise. And it looks like a well-matched card in which, of course, as per usual, we will be breaking down from bottom to top, betting, techniques, analysis, hot takes, and yes, as you've come to know in the Protect Your Neck Podcast, random tangents in all the forms that they may come and they may take. They may be a little more colorful. Let me take a breath here. It's been a bit of a crazy week, but then you all say it's a crazy week and you're always tired and you're always insane. I think they know that. Shh, let's not. Let's not peel back the curtain too much, Dan. Let's not peel it back too much. It's been a crazy week, but in a good way. Nothing to complain about. As far as personally, business-wise, and all this stuff. A lot of stuff going on in the works. Was able to see my old buddy Angelo Reyes there and Jeremy Long, Cage Siders. They're kind enough to have me do their show for UFC 209. And they had a new studio because they're doing stuff for TV here out here. And it's really cool. Felt like I was like the anchor man, you know. Like I wanted to say inappropriate things, but I couldn't. I couldn't be Ron Burgundy. But it was really cool being on that little It's actually pretty nice, sizable studio those guys got there. And they're doing big things, doing a lot of promotion for boxing and MMA here in Vegas. So thanks, guys, and shouts to Cage Siders. Go ahead and follow them. I believe it's at Cage Siders. I recently retweeted some stuff, and you know, y'all are following me if you're listening to this. Flying Catastrophe. So. Cool. Yeah, thank you guys for having me on. And then I did a little impromptu. My buddy Goz, I hope he's feeling better. He's been sounding like death. That's right. Goz Garcia, co-host to MMA Junkie Radio. So he had no voice, and poor guy was struggling. So I came in this morning to co-host MMA Junkie Radio. So thank you, Gorgeous George, for having me, and I hope Goz feels better. Was awesome chatting with my man Danny too, a serious producer, one of my favorite, one of the best in his band, Automatic 253. But yeah, so it was a good day. Again, nothing to complain about, but if I'm a little delirious, sleep, you know, deprived, well, it's because I'm delirious and sleep deprived. So don't let that fool you. We're going to push through. We're going to push through strong, and we're going to get to this is a business right here and for to and from. Let's start from the bottom here. This is not officially on My Fights to Avoid, although it feels like it should have been. I don't know why I stick to this unwritten rule of three, if at all. I know the format's kind of been jumpy. Thank y'all for hanging with me. But yeah, this first one is definitely Fights to Avoid, although not officially listed. And that is, yes, female division. We have Ketlin Vieira versus Ashley Evans-Smith. Evan Smith coming in here at the favorite. Let's see, you know, I think she's in the minus 185 range. Let's see. Yeah. And probably climbing, depending what house you're looking at. Probably by morning, I'd expect maybe minus 200. I don't think there's a lot of hype on Ketlin Vieira. You know, it's hard. She's young, but she's also been training since she was young. Vieira, the Brazilian, you know, she's been training judo and jiu-jitsu. She's about 12 years old. And she's really young in her career. She's probably only like 20, 24 months deep at this point. She debuted at the Portland card against Kelly Fastholtz, and man, it took Fastholtz again. You know, those durable, crafty, volume strikers in the female divisions tend to do well in the scorecards. But it was a split decision, which I completely agree with. By the way, I had Ketlin Vieira winning that clear. But yeah, she showed us some chops. Obviously, she's not at her, you know, Nova and Yao counterpart level as far as the stand up and things go. But wrestling against the cage, top control, passing. And yes, even though maybe the technique's not the same on the feet, the same spirit is there. So it's really tough. She should be the underdog, but it's hard to, you know, gauge where the fight-to-fight improvements are going to be for Caitlin Vieira. Whereas Ashley Evans-Smith, she's, you know, hasn't been active for a minute. I believe she had a fight scheduled and didn't fall through. She had the Jermaine Duranemi fight, if memory serves. But yeah, I mean, there's a lot to like about her game. I mean, a lot of that viral knockout and Tough Enough wasn't flattering. I might have been at that one, actually. I know I've seen Ashley Evans-Smith fight in Tough Enough before. You know, that's real popular out here in Vegas. Ronda Rousey, a bunch of people came through it. Alan Joban, people I was lucky enough to see. I fought on there too. In fact, I posted a picture recently following me on Twitter of me getting my ass kicked from Marvin Eastman's son. I think I picked like the most least flattering picture of the whole fight. And I went with that because that's the move, right? Because, yeah, you got to be able to laugh. And it really is funny in retrospect. And it's also cool kind of seeing, you know, looking at the cards. I believe like Jocelyn Jones Liebarger was on that card. Ronda Rousey fought on the card before that, which was their last Tough Enough last card in the ring. And I believe I fought on the first one where they had the cage. And that was a big deal because we're like, oh, UFC, bro, we get to fight in the cage. Yay. But yeah, got to see a lot of my experience, obviously, super limited, more coaching, cornering, and supporting my friends than competing, obviously. But the big benefit to those days that I'm kind of getting nostalgic on is getting to see, you know, names of today, you know, from big ones to not as big ones kind of come through. And yeah, I don't know. I'm just weird and hardcore, and I'll eat MMA any way you kind of feed it to me because I'm a nut like that and just will watch it from a regional to amateur level. But Ashley Evans-Smith, you know, she's improved a lot. She puts together her punches well. She favors the straight jabs and crosses, some hard tie kicks. But, you know, her wrestling background, you know, three-time state wrestling champ, I believe, you know, high school accolades granted, but, you know, she's been grappling for a minute. I'm not sure if she's still a blue belt in BJJ. You often see those kind of ranks stagnate, as they arguably should in MMA, because fighters usually are focusing outside of the gi than within the gi. And yes, there are definite benefits to the gi, even if you're an MMA fighter, so I'm not going to have that argument here, now, or then, nor do I feel like I'm the qualified person to have that argument, because I'm terrible in the gi, to be honest. So, but yeah, the point, I guess, I'm trying to say is, you know, Ashley Evans-Smith's grappling probably a little better than the accolades present, but that's what she's facing here, is another grappler. And I think if you want to go chalk, or, you know, Ashley Evans-Smith has the edge, as I believe she should, I believe Ashley Evans-Smith certainly has the edge on the feet. Again, I'm avoiding it, you know. This might be a fight where, like, if it happened later in the card and I'm already kind of plus money early, you know, I put, like, you know, just like one of those fun $3 bets just to make it interesting, but nope, this is the opener I'm avoiding, but picking the favorite. Next fight on the card, it's going to go to, clicking back here. Nathan Coy versus Cummins. I've been pretty high on Cummins. You know, again, he fits that one of my favorite underdog tropes, durable southpaws who can wrestle. And you know, I picked him against, you know, Ponzinibbio, which was a mistake. And, you know, Ponzi, you know, did great there. And but I don't think Coy has that athleticism, you know. Coy is super tough, and, you know, I'm sure he's a great dude. And he's been around for a minute. I mean, this guy's got victories over, you know, Rick Story, I believe, a split decision with Tyron Woodley. I mean, he's been around the circuits. But the inactivity, you know, trouble is troublesome at the age, the wear, the tear, and I think Cummins is a guy who is already accustomed to making fights ugly, whereas, you know, you get guys who need fights to be clean in a certain way, and a guy like Nathan Coy comes along and could be a deceptive underdog in that sense, but Cummins has a bit of the same spirit, again, except he's a bit of a, I hate to say higher grade, like that's some nose in the air, you know, term that's disrespectful to Coy, but yeah, I believe he's at a different level here, and the line is justified, but way too high. You know, I'm not sure what it's at now, I believe, but let me see, I believe it was like 390 or in that area last time I looked. You're 380 there. Yeah, or three plus 380, I should say, for Nathan Coy, and plus four, yeah, minus 475 for Zach Cummings. Way too high. Even at, you know, if it was minus 380 for Zach Cummings, be a little too high. Something seems a little, I don't know, I got a weird feeling about this one. It didn't make, you know, parlay pieces. I may have Zach Cummings in one thing, but I pretty much stayed away. And the next fight on the card, I definitely stayed away from because, by the way, pick is Cummings there, obviously. Next fight, I definitely stayed away from. This is Anthony, you know, this is Andrew Sanchez versus Anthony Lionheart Smith. And Anthony Smith isn't the most impressive record, you know, especially when you just look at it on paper, but as experienced as he is, the guy's only 28 years old, and I think he's finding his stride. And you hear people like Brian Stann or people on the inside talk about this guy in the gym, and you wonder, is it going to be another classic case of a guy who kind of never makes it? And, you know, he'll make some real questionable decisions in fights, but he is tough as shit, and I don't see, you know, the at least, you know, stereotypical tropes of quits or anything like that. Or looking for ways out, even though, again, there's just sometimes really, you know, Smith, that is, really questionable decisions. And Sanchez, he's growing too. He's younger and definitely has more trajectory to grow, as he should be. And I'm sure that's what the odds makers are counting on, is, you know, you've got Andrew Sanchez here is, you know, minus, let's see, minus 340. Oh boy. I don't know about that, though. I mean, he shows improvements in the feet. You know, he kind of has that karate back-and-forth gauging, which I'm a big fan of, but it's risky. Even if you're Stephen Wonderboy Thompson, it's risky, and we've seen Andrew Sanchez clipped. And when you're relying on that head movement, especially at these higher weight classes, you're going to get tired and become more hittable, and when you become more hittable, the risks are more heavier as the weight is more heavier. You know, so both guys have had gas tank, you know, criticisms. I think you can make cases, you know, small, big, and definitely different on each side. But again, you can make arguable cases. And that's what's kind of keeping me away from the Sanchez play. Although his wrestling and grappling should be able to do the trick, especially if, you know, Anthony Smith takes another round off like he did in his last fight. But then again, he also looked better in different ways because you heard of the medical condition, which kind of supported the theory of, oh, is it a guy that, you know, like I just said, is it the guy that just stays in the gym and never makes it to the octagon? But then when there's an actual, you know, medical reasoning that he wasn't been addressing this whole time. And aside from the fact that you've got guys like Brian Stann, people on the inside, you know, vouching for this kid, this makes it a real deceptive spot, especially if, you know, Sanchez, I like it. He rips those body shots and he has the dirty boxing, and then he'll break and strike from the clinch. But he dips his head a little low in there, and especially if he's going for takedowns, he's going to dip his head lower, and Anthony Smith makes his money in the clinch, so something to watch out for. And not only that, Anthony Smith kind of shows, especially in the last fight, he was showing his different levels of attack. You know, he was not just, you know, going to the clinch, which I've always, if you've heard me break him down in past fights, I always kind of hail him there, but he was smoothly mixing the three different ranges from, you know, a tie clinch to a knee. They're starting to exit pocket range. He goes to an elbow, and then the next follow-up shot, you know, keeping the consistency and economy of movement from the other side, it's a left hook, and then he's punching, you know, and extending out from there. He's turning his shoulders when he extends. So he's following his opponents on the way out. So a guy who's kind of leaning and lunging and depending on that low-handed karate stance, you know, a dangerous, heavy-handed guy with a reach, aggressiveness, multiple tools, and is going to follow up given the opportunity. Could be dangerous pickings for Andrew Sanchez. So that is why that's on my avoid, especially at that price. We still have a lot to learn about these guys for different reasons. I mean, again, Smith much more experienced than Sanchez. Sanchez we should have a lot more learn about as far as MMA realm. But Smith, again, deceptive, only 28 despite his experience, one of those skewed sample sizes. So could be a late blossomer. This could be the fight for him to show it, though, if he's going to do it. I'd stay away. I don't blame you for playing Smith if you like him there. All right, let's see. Is this the next fight on our fights to avoid? Almost. It almost made it, but I feel the line is pretty correct, as these guys are lined pretty closely. We have Devin Clark, a slight favorite, minus 115, and Collier as the dog. Yeah, plus 120. Yeah, it's I agree. I had Uda over Collier in the last fight. Collier kind of showed that the, you know, the poor man Tim Means spirit can kind of come through, and you know, was able to withstand the barrage and a busted nose from Uda. I was actually at that fight and was just really surprised. Nice little spin kick there, and that dude definitely has dog in him, you know, and is capable, you know, from strikes to submissions and strikes in the clinch, and obviously, you know, strikes in space. He's a scrapper. He's gonna bring the fight, and which is why I'm probably staying away from this one, although it's not on my official stay away. Odds makers seem a little indecisive. You've got an over and under at 1.5, which, by the way, I'm not a big fan on any of the over and unders, which is probably not too much of a surprise. You know, I'm usually not big there. There's a tempting over, which I'll talk about later, but kind of tipping my hand as far as plays, there's not a lot that I like, and there's not a lot, because I really do think, you know, it wasn't just hyperbole in the beginning of this. I really do think this is a well-matched card, and man, I don't even like a lot of the ones where it's like, you know, Danton parlay fodder, where it's like, you know, fight doesn't go the distance or fight does. Usually you can count that I at least have one of those, not just my plays, but maybe even my core plays. And I don't think I have any of that. And same goes for this fight here. I expect Devin Clark to show more of his evolution, hopefully more in the striking. He was kind of letting loose despite getting caught by Alex Nicholson, and which, by the way, he was, you know, had his moments of success against Nicholson as well. But I expect him to come through here. You know, a lot of people high on him. I believe Jackson Winkie's working with. And, yeah, I expect him to take Jake Collier, you know, for the low price. If you like Devin Clark, it's a bargain. I don't blame you. Not sure Collier's worth the shot at the price he's coming in. But yeah, the pick here is Clark. No plays there. All right, the next one, I believe, is it the Fight Pass headliner? Yes, it is. And it is also the second on the fights to avoid. There's always that 1/11th hour pick where I'll admit we're like, even though I didn't do a write-up on this one, but it's like I almost feel like I'm deciding who I want to win as I'm writing it because it's so close. Like, all the analysis is done, but I'm just grappling with the narrative and the ways in which the fight can shake out in my head. And this one, I was so close to going with Mendez, even though I came in with Sterling, but I ended up leaving with the same person I came in siding with, and that's Aljamain Sterling. You know me, I'm not one for narrative. MMA doesn't give a shit that Aljamain needs this win desperately, and so does his camp right now. MMA doesn't give two craps about that narrative. But in looking at Sterling's last fight, although I didn't agree with maybe some of the tactical choices, and listening to interviews, refreshingly, Sterling didn't agree either, and it was kind of something that I thought in my head might be that I think the criticisms were getting to his head, and I really appreciated the honesty, and I'm a real big fan of Sterling, by the way, of, you know, his personality and the honesty in which he kind of approached that and admitted that and how it affected him. So I expect him, whether you like his style of, you know, gauging with kicks and not really doing damage and putting the volume and boxing range up in numbers per se, I do expect him to do that here against Tinquinho Mendez, because Mendez is really developing himself in boxing range. He has heavy hands, and I'm really, the line is just so off, and I think maybe that's what was kind of making me go toward Mendez, because when I look at it, he has, you know, the boxing range, heavy hands. He doesn't throw himself out of position to be taken down, and if he does get taken down, he's good. He's not just good in the gi, folks. He's a no-gi champion as well, and also, you know, when you look at his game in MMA, no-gi and gi, he's very confident off of his back and on top. So he's going to be a handful for Sterling wherever this goes. And I'm a big fan of Sterling's grappling, but as you know, I picked Caraway against him, and not just because of, you know, being a homer from Extreme Couture, knowing Caraway, but Caraway is an underrated grappler, whether you like the guy or not. That's just a fact. The dude is an underrated grappler who a lot of his performances, you know, and he admits this himself, been mental. Dude struggles with anxiety badly. And again, not peeling the curtain back I'm a homie there, because it's something he's admitted in publicly, you know, in interviews. So, but as awesome as Aljamain Sterling is, he's one of my favorite submissions against Takeo Mizugaki. This is something that I would constantly try to hit from the gym in transitions where, you're getting shooken off from the back, or a guy's turtled up and you know hit that head and arm choke, but you hit it from that weird 45 degree angle and almost apply that rear naked choke grip. And man, if I had the long limbs of Aljo, I would be doing the same thing all up and down the mat. And I'm really excited for the scrambles, but I think Aljamain's going to be very opportunistic in which he engages with grappling and his takedowns. I wouldn't be surprised to see him take down, back out, and really kind of explore and utilize his funk style. You know, or maybe, you know, if you've been listening to this podcast, start to pick up. I'm a real big fan of awkward fighters, awkward grapplers, funk style wrestlers. I really dig Sterling's style. So I think he's really going to go back to that. He's going to definitely need to if he wants to beat Tanquinho. And I know Tanquinho got hurt by Frankie Saenz, but Saenz, although Saenz gets hurt a lot, which, you know, chin criticisms can be well-deserved and fair towards Saenz, but then again, the guy's much older and fighting in a lighter weight. What do you expect? But Saenz, underrated, though, is what I'm trying to say. Underrated striking, heavy hands, and so not only does that, you know, all excuse, you know, Tanquinho Mendes getting hit and stunned a couple times, there was not an inch of quit in Mendes's eyes. So even though it looks bad getting hit that many times, that fight showed me more than I think Aljo showed in his career. And Aljo's fought obviously way more in the UFC and just is a more experienced MMA fighter all around than Tanquinho Mendes. So that says a lot, you know, that three-round war of Frankie Saenz. You see a guy get hurt, take down an accoladed wrestler, although, you know, he wasn't able to hold him down, which, again, if you know Saenz's wrestling accolades and his scrambling style, difficult guy to hold down. So, I mean, arguments and excusables there. You know, not trying to make excuses for him or anybody for that matter, but definite arguments and excusables, you know, excuses to have that done so. All right, I'm going to take a sip of beer here, and no wheat beer, no hell or high watermelon. Brandon Dell on Facebook, shout out to you, sir, and look like you were enjoying yourself some. Not for everybody. I'm not a wheat or a fruity beer, although that's not, they do a really good job with mixing that one, as I will argue. I'm an IPA guy, unabashedly. I'm an IPA guy, and this is a double IPA. Henderson, I'm going local today. This is a Love Lady Brewery here in Henderson, Nevada, where I grew up mostly, aside from Hawaii. So yeah, cheers. Thank you, Love Lady. They make an awesome double IPA. It's probably not available unless you're in Vegas, so sorry, but hey, cheers anyways. All right, Luis Smoka versus Tim Elliott. This one almost made it into my fights to avoid. Again, not a lot here when, you know, I'm saying, you know, half the fights should be on my fights to avoid if they're not already. Y'all know I'm a big Luis Smoka fan. I agree with him being the underdog to Tim Elliott, but I do believe the line's a little off. So I don't blame you if you're taking a shot on Luis Smoka, is because, you know, we'll get to Dark Horse talk in a second. You know, I know I like to abuse that term, and eventually, people we think that are dark horses, like Valentina Shevchenko or a fighter later on in the card, eventually it isn't, because everybody starts calling the dark horse, hence they're not really the dark horse. And as much as, you know, we like to pat ourselves on the back, and I do the same, this is one where I was wrong about. Maybe not wrong, he's still very young, but I guess I was maybe wrongly high about. And that was Luis Smoka. I had him as the dark horse to challenge Demetrius Johnson. Even though there's some arguable mental falters there when you listen to interviews. I know he does interviews a lot with MMA Junkie Radio, who obviously, you know, I listen to, I homework for, and co-host from time to time here. So, he was also my man. Jordan Killian's podcast, Pound for Pound podcast with Sam Alvey. And he's a really cool dude, man, but there's definitely some mental and discipline issues, and he admits this himself, so this isn't too much speculation and shitting on the kid. But that said, I will defend his grappling style, because again, not just awkward grapplers, but different grappling styles I'm a fan of, and this is one where he would tie me up in knots, and no way am I comparing myself to Luis Smoka, but in my kind of grappling style, I'm a practitioner of seceding the small battles to win the bigger wars, and that is what Luis Smolka does. And even if you're a grappler, it's not one of those things. If you're not a grappler, you don't know, bro. Because I hate to do that. There's a lot of educated people who don't practice martial arts and cover the sport and do a good job and do their due diligence. So I'm not trying to feed that stereotype or anything, but because even grapplers have a hard time understanding Luis Smolka's style. And it's very dangerous. I don't recommend it, especially when strikes are involved, especially at the highest levels of MMA, when strikes are involved, giving up bad positions become much more detrimental in that aspect, you know? And as a guy who thrives and likes to create chaos himself, Tim Elliott could capitalize. You know, Tim Elliott, when you look at his record and kind of everything's perspective, it could be really impressive when you look at that. Oh, he had a couple moments against DJ, but really lost the rest of the fight. And you look at his overall record and everything past that, and a lot of the things that have burned him, or a lot of the things that have burned Luis Smolka, have burned Tim Elliott, you know, as far as getting too comfortable in that chaos, depending on it too much, getting burned. And we've seen both guys subject to that, you know, with guillotine chokes, giving their head and just being too comfortable in their defense, because they are great defensive grapplers as well as chaotic grapplers, but the yin and the yang doesn't always mix in this game. So I expect chaos. I'm just going to be watching this as a fan of the scrambles, as a fan of the grappling. But I may put a small shot of this line keeps growing on Luis Smolka, because I sure as shit ain't playing Tim for that price. You know, -2 to -3 to 1 favorites, depending what houses you're looking at here. I jumped between Bovada and Five Times, by the way. Sorry, I've been clarifying what I've been pulling from. And again, it's probably changing by the time you're reading this, so it's better probably just to keep it vague and keep the analysis specific, because that's probably the only reason why y'all listen to me, and I don't blame you. All right, we're going to take a break after this next fight, but we're going to cover this next fight first, and that is the first recommended parlay piece, and that is Rashid Magomedov, who is favored against Bobby Green. I believe this opened in the -2.5 range, quickly got up to 3, if not maybe opened right at 3 flat maybe. I'm bad at that. I don't really look at openers. I'm usually clocking my analysis. I try to stay out of that early play game. There's some people who are really good at it, you know, some good cappers, and they have their strategies in their game, and I hate and stick to that. Keep winning, keep cashing, keep doing your thing. But I with my style, I really just try to keep away from the narrative. I pride myself in cutting through the narrative, which means, unfortunately, I miss out on a lot of these early lines where a lot of other guys are kind of cashing. But I'm okay with that because, again, that's not my game. I do the odds and stuff because it's fun. Sure, I'm going in depth and have a podcast about it, but, again, I know my lane, and I stay in my lane, and my lane is analysis, and even that, I'm still a humble student in, so appreciate y'all for listening, and I'll do my best to hold up that end. But yes, I don't blame you for being scared away from this. I was having a conversation with my man Z. By the way, shout out to @RockstarZ, who recently went tout. Again, if you're cappers or into that stuff or a fan of those guys, go check him out. It's a good reference. And if you don't want to pay the tout game, I don't blame you. He's good about producing videos where if you read between the lines, you'll get him for a reference point. And again, whether you like these people or not, you got to give credit where credit's due. And that is somebody I have given credit to before and give credit to now, because homeboy hustles, just like, you know, my man Levy over there, who I always give shout outs and props to, and the other people too, Kelton, Prophet, all y'all who take the time and reach out. I really enjoy this friendly community, man. So can't say I appreciate that enough. But yes, me and Z were having a conversation about that. I'm not sure if he was playing Green, but definitely was bringing up good points about, you know, Magomedov and his volume and stuff that have costed him before. And that's kind of why I picked against him back in the day, which was, in hindsight, bad. It was one of only two misses that night. I picked Burns against him. You know, picked the wrong jiu-jitsu world champion, because Dariush was the guy who actually took him to task. Shout out to Benny. But I'm a big fan of Rashid's style. I don't think the volume costs him here, because even though there's an intensity and activeness to Bobby Green, there's an arguable inactiveness that have cost him because he wasn't able to pull triggers at certain points, whether it be it grappling guys when he needs to grapple them and punch guys when he needs to punch them, because I'm a big fan of Bobby Green. I think he's really underrated. Excuse me. In fact, UFC 199, I think my 11th hour pick for that one was Dustin Poirier because I was struggling. I almost went with Bobby Green on that fight. And, you know, in retrospect, it would have looked dumb if I went with him, right? But no, I mean, Bobby Green is really underrated. But with his personal drama, inactivity, and to in-fight discipline, none of these things kind of cooperate well, if that's probably not even the right word. I'm sorry, it's late. Drinking, sleep deprived. Again, it's the only way I bring you this podcast. I shouldn't even use that as an excuse, as it's become a regular. But yeah, it's hard to back Bobby Green with those intangibles at play. And whether they show through or not, whether you agree with them or not, they are at play. I mean, these are near facts here as far as how they interfere with the fight game or potentially could. Wishing him the best. He looks great in shape as far as the limited social media that is out there on the guy. Training at Pinnacle as he normally does. But it's that low-handed style. And again, I'm a fan of, you know, I'll defend low-handed styles as far as whether, you know, it's guys with more boxing-centric, you know, head movement, slip, ripping, baiting, or obviously more my lane, which is karate, traditional martial arts, taekwondo. But yeah, it's really bad against a guy like Rashid Magomedov, who's accurate with his shot selection from hands to feet. And one of my favorite things, if you read my breakdowns on Magomedov before, I talk about it all the time, it's his lead leg kicks. He's really good at punctuating his combinations with not just kicks, but sneaking them over the shoulder. Not as flamboyantly as Stephen Thompson, all of his knockout win over Dan Stigeon, but much more consistent and much more concise, much more compact and effective as far as long term. I mean, you know, Stephen Thompson, when he hits his kicks, they're their highlight reels, but as far as, you know, just efficiency maybe is the word I'm looking for here. I really like Rashid and could see him, you know, hurting Bobby Green with this, the way they kind of line up. When I talk about stylistic antithesis, is, you know, why I pick Jim Miller over Alves, but yet why I pick Alves over Cote. Certain guys line up in certain ways, and MMA, forget what you know and what you've seen in past scenarios. It's a case-by-case scenario. You know, the intangibles, yes, they're at play. I just made an argument for him, but when it comes down to it, the most important argument, case-by-case scenario. So, yeah, but I don't know where, you know, Rashid Magomedov is training right now, if he's training American Top Team. It's hard to tell because usually I think he just trains with the, you know, he usually has just like the Russian guys in his corner anyway. Although it would be awesome to see, like, you know, Conan Silverio in his corner, which I was talking with Goz today. Is like, Conan Silverio, by the way, is he not the Brazilian Hodor? Like, by the way, Hodor, terrible cornerman, right? Like, Hodor would be just like awful, but considering the stage in today's UFC's heavyweight division, I think Hodor can make a good run toward the title, though, right? I mean, let's be honest. Hodor could probably, with two wins, I think he'd be fighting Stipe, or if not, he could, you know, be a gatekeeper. He could hold the door, if you will, at the top five or top ten. But if Rizin were to get Hodor, then it's just forget anything. He's fighting Gabby Garcia. That's the fight you have to make. Hodor versus Gabby Garcia. See, that'd be awesome. You gotta have I was talking with Goz, by the way. You gotta have it's like if WME, if they just go completely nuts. I'm going, here's the tangent I warned you about. Here it is, folks. Game of Thrones versus UFC main card. I got it. We got Hodor versus Stipe Miocic for the heavyweight title. We gotta have an action fight that's like a featherweight or lightweight to open up the pay-per-view, right? So that's gotta be, ooh, let's do Darren Elkins versus that eunuch guy from Game of Thrones, because both those guys will fight to the burger, right? I mean, you know what I'm saying? Like, you just take limbs off of those guys, and they're going to keep going. So that'll open the card. Then you do, God, Tyrion Lannister is a motherfucker. He's a fan favorite. Like, you got to have him in there, but, you know, look at the whole flyweight division, and I don't think Tyrion Lannister, like, holds a straw to any of those guys, so Here's what you do. You go WWE style. You have Tyrion Lannister get inside the octagon, and you're just like, who's he going to fight? Who's the mystery opponent? What's going on? Fucking music hits. Smoke, you know, smoke fills the runway. You see a silhouette of someone walking through. You know, you get the, you know, maybe he's JR's voice because it's full WWE. Like, who's coming through the smoke? By God, it's Joe Silva. Joe Silva's back. Joe Silva versus Tyrion Lannister. Joe Silva's got his leather jacket. He's just power walking down the fucking ramp. Oh, that'd be fucking epic. You got to have the mountain, but I don't think the mountain can make heavyweight. So you do super heavyweight, but then you got to get a UFC fighter who can't make the heavyweight limit either. He's got to be in the same boat. So here's what you do. You do, oh yeah, here's what you do. Hey, Tim Sylvia. Yeah. I heard you want to come back to the UFC. We're coming back to Bangalore. Oh, Bangalore, that's awesome. Tim Sylvia versus the fucking mountain. Oh, God, that'd be great. Yeah, I think there's your five-fight main card right there. I think that's five fights. No, you need one more. Jon Snow. Oh, you know they're doing Jon Snow versus Sage Northcutt. That's happening. Dark versus light, baby. That's the WME poster boy match right there. Jon Snow versus Sage Northcutt. All right. On the note of the Game of Thrones UFC main card, wasted enough time. We are going to take a break, and I am probably going to fill my drink, although I don't need to, as we'll be back to finish the prelims and the main card for UFC on Fox 24, Kansas City. Cucarachas enojadas. We're back right here on the Protect Connect podcast for the breakdown of UFC on Fox 24. Hashtag UFC Kansas City. As we are almost to the main card, we are actually finishing up on the prelim as we are on my second recommended parlay piece. Yes, you survived the Game of Thrones main card, and we are back onto the action. Tom Dukinois versus Patrick Williams. As if you don't know, all you have to do now is look at the lines to know that there is a lot of hype on Tom Dukinois, but there's a lot of justification for that. You know, as you all know, France is not as, you know, a condemnable a country to come from MMA from. There's a strong negative stereotype that they weren't able to, you know, produce good fighters, and, you know, for good reason, though. Not anything against the French, just it wasn't legal, you know. A lot of French professional fighters were having to go up, you know, up north mainly, you know, to fight, you know, up in, you know, Swedish cards, and it was really common to find a lot of Parisian fighters, or obviously, yes, the Bama and the UK circuits, too. So that's where, you know, Bama, Tom Dukinois has kind of come up through. So if you've been watching Bama, you have certainly seen this young man. Amazing sense for the game. I mean, you know, he definitely has a good kickboxing, which, by the way, that is one thing Paris has, from Muay Thai to European style kickboxing and everything in kind of in between. Paris has, you know, kind of produced good schools of martial artists within that realm. And, you know, Dukinois definitely shows those chops, especially, you know, with the Muay Thai. But I really like the way in which he kind of has a sense inside the pocket, and he'll kind of slip in transition. And I don't know if he'll go to a takedown, but he'll kind of, like, slip off and come to the side and almost, like, check into somebody, like a hockey check, but then come up and strike off the break, parlay it into a takedown, or kind of whatever's appropriate, depending on the space, depending on the scenario. But you know me, shout out to at John's Crazy Life, as he did the How I Watch Fights. For me, one of my main things is that the truth is in the transition. The truth is in the transition, and it's the small spaces that impress me most. It's not if a guy can get a flying triangle or a this or a that. That's not what, you know, that's not what's impressing me. It's not how Tom's finishing his fights. It's the little spaces in between, you know, in those spaces in the pocket and on the floor, the way in which he transitions, and more specifically, the way in which he floats positions. It's hard to explain, but I think especially wrestlers, as far as grapplers go, more specifically, would understand this, that there are certain ways that a guy floats where you just know he understands grappling, you know, where he is looking very effortless, kind of putting his belly on certain areas, you know, just resting on his belly at certain points to, you know, as far as, you know, top pressure and then floating to the next, you know, going to north-south to get away from any potential guard retentions and taking that route as opposed to the normal knee across the belly and playing into the legs and getting caught right back in into a half guard. Again, if, you know, y'all have been listening to this podcast, you know that I favor me for some north-south as far as, you know, I get it. No, but seriously, I think it's a very underused route as far as grappling goes because it takes the legs completely out of the equation and, you know, puts a different value on the hips. You can still be countered because depending on how you play it, if you're not putting your, you know, ear to their pelvis bone or putting a hand or Billy Robbins style, as I like to do, put a fist right next to their hip. You know, especially the way in which they're kind of circling into you. They like to do that Marty McFly kind of air guitar walk. You know, you see guys try to do that, and Tom Dukinwa does a good job of going north-south, getting away from guard retentions, then coming back over for a mount and working his game from there, whether he's trying to go for strikes, submissions, or both. A lot to like about this guy, whereas, you know, Patrick Williams is tough. The 38-year-old bantamweight is really inconsistent. I think, like, 2 fights in 3 years or something ridiculous, or 20-something months. I mean, it's really tough. It looks like they owed him a fight here. When you look at the way his record was split, you know, he had the weird flying knee, and then I think the flying knee loss. Oh, gosh, I'm getting all mixed up now. This is why you don't drink in podcasts, people. That's right. The guillotine choke was the win, and then, yes, the flying knee was the loss. The Chris Beal one always sticks in my head. Because that one just kind of fed the Chris Beal line at the time, which was fine because I believe I made money fading Chris Beal after his victory over Patrick Williams here in 2014. But yeah, he caught Alejandro Perez in that weird guillotine. Reminded me of that Efren Escudero. Is it Leandro Silva? No, that wasn't Leandro Silva fight. Dober? Perhaps that's what it was, Dober. I don't know. Y'all know what I'm talking about. It's a very similar setup as far as standing guillotine super early in the fight. You're just like, that just happened. this is probably the most closest I'll come to discounting a guy and kind of skipping over. But for obvious reasons, this is one where you can do the old sure dog breakdown and y'all will be okay. You don't need me breaking down this guy. He's pretty awkward in all his transitions from ground exchanges and engagements to striking itself. So, 35 years old, not 38. Wow. I'm really just counting him out over here. Sorry, the animal, Patrick Williams. We're going to move on, though, to the last fight. This is the first dog, and I believe the second official dog pick overall that I took. But there's a stated bias here. That's right. Alexander Volkov versus Roy Nelson. As you know, I scouted for Roy for his Bigfoot fight. I worked with Roy and his team for that one. And thankfully, it went well for Roy. Sadly, he didn't understand that kicking John McCarthy. Like, I put that in as a joke. Like, I was like, that's not a part of the game plan. I probably should emphasize that more because Roy went all the way through and he kept going and didn't understand that was a joke and he kicked John McCarthy. I'm just kidding. It wasn't my fault. That wasn't in the scouting report. That was completely on Roy. But yeah, hey, whatever. Fuck it. But so thankfully, you know, Extreme Couture bias, granted. I mean, there's obviously friendly relations there. I don't need to draw the pictures for you, but it was a good run the last time, so I helped Roy this time for Volkov and did a big, big scouting report for him. So I'm going to walk a fine line with how I kind of break this one down, but essentially, you know, Volkov's very experienced, and there's a lot of things to like, but wrestling and more Western MMA stylings in the cage and the way we kind of judge fights here as opposed to the weird freaking decisions when you really go deep in this guy's record. Because when I do a scouting report, I watch everything possible. Everything possible, literally. And formulate it through. And although I'm kind of being reserved on what I say, I can't honestly tell you that I have no part in the game plan, nor do I want a part in that madness. My job, as you know, I'm sure other people have different ways, and or other people can probably sign off on this. As an analyst doing a scouting report, your job kind of comes in as an analyst early on in camp before things are, you know, at least if the team knows what they're doing, your job should come in early on in camp when they're still trying to formulate a game plan while their athlete's still getting in shape and they're in the conditioning phases of the camp. That's when, you know, the coaches should be formulating game plans, if not have one already, getting hard numbers, hard line approaches, and that's when sometimes they'll bring in analysts like myself, by the way, for scouting, mixedmartialanalyst.com. Email me, dantom07@yahoo.com. Little shameless plug there. It's my podcast. I can give a shameless plug. But yeah, but no, I mean, the role, it's really not that I downplay it. It's really not that important. It's just, if they're smart, they're using us early, and they're just using us for reference points. We have no part in the game plan, nor should we, nor do I want any part in that. So there's nothing giving away here. But what I will say is that what we've seen from Roy, from vintage Roy to more recent Roy, which I believe has been a smarter Roy since he's been working with Eric Nixick. Shout out Eric Nixick, general manager at Extreme Couture, who has been, you know, just a coach, trainer, all-around great guy before he, you know, even took any official roles for about a decade. He's Extreme Couture family, treats everybody like family, great guy, and he's in the corner of a lot of fighters now because he's a really knowledgeable and smart cat. Shout out to Eric Nixick. But, you know, you might not be as, you know, fan-friendly, you know, as far as we're grappling more, but you can never make, it just goes to prove, you can never make MMA fans happy. Even when Roy was knocking people out, they're like, oh, he's so good at jiu-jitsu, just imagine if he used it. And granted, Roy hasn't been the most successful at using his jiu-jitsu, and, you know, when you look at his record on paper and just judge it from that, yes, I mean, obviously he's not even been as successful as obviously he'd like to be. No disillusions there. So please, you know, add the proper adjustment to my opinions here, as there's a little bit of homering. But yeah, no secret, old approach or new approach, they're both applicable to Volkov, from the wrestling to the intercepting of strikes, you know, especially overhand rights to the tall fighters like Volkov, you know, very susceptible. And although it was an uppercut that Tim Johnson almost iced him with, that was, I'm sure, a valuable asset, I should say, to Roy Nelson, as, you know, Tim Johnson, as y'all know, been training at Extreme Couture for the last couple camps. So really cool to have Timmy Big Dick as the MMA analysis. Shout out to those guys. Some of the OGs over there, Brad, Lance Fischel, and those MMA gamblers all over there, Jay Primetown. But that's why I heard the Timmy Big Dick phrase, so just kind of giving credit where credit's due. But yeah, it's been cool to see him in the gym, and I'm sure that, you know, that was helpful to Roy, working with him. But yeah, I'll say this, especially when you look at Roy's skill set, I wouldn't be surprised, and I don't even know if it's going to go this way, but I mean, I like to compare it to a Tyron Woodley. You know, when you look at the right hand and the wrestling dynamic and the different ways you can use that, whether you're being aggressive or from a countering perspective, the reason why I compare it to Tyron Woodley and the reason why I feel like I can say that and that doesn't give away too much is because you can either criticize Woodley, as, you know, many, even myself, did early, that he's got a limited skill set, and, you know, similar criticisms have been, you know, lofted Roy's way. Oh, he just got the right hand, that's it. But when you kind of look at the science of how certain guys intercept, set up, and kind of create these opportunities to be there and can use them in different dynamics, whether offensively or off the counter, you kind of can see that, okay. Yeah, I get it. It can be much more effective than we give it credit for. So I think it's going to be a kind of a taste of this, and a dog money plus 100. Yeah, I'm putting my money where my mouth is. I played Roy, put him in a parlay as well, because I felt he was a good dog piece. As far as that goes, I feel this is a very winnable fight for three rounds. Take him down or knock him out. We'll see how he goes about it exactly, but I believe he can do it. And that brings us to the main card. Jeremy Stephens versus Renato Moicano Carneiro. A lot of people high on Moicano. I just feel like there's still a lot to see, and he's still young and he's developing. So, I actually went against him in his last fight against Tukhugov. And you want a split decision, which I thought it was pretty, not clear, but fairly clear that it was Moicano. I had no problem. I picked the other guy and scored it for the guy that, I didn't pick, and no issue there. But man, I don't agree with the line. I don't think Jeremy Stephens is getting enough respect here. He is the quintessential underdog, as you heard, As you heard me talk on a recent Top 5 Underdog podcast. Jeremy Stephens, he's been underdog in 6 of his last 8 fights. Not an underdog in this fight. He's a favorite, minus 185, but I believe still the line is off that it's even kind of this close, as Jeremy Stephens is a recommended parlay piece. He is the third one, that's right. And if you parlay all 3 of them, probably not now, because Dukinois, I believe I got him at 470 and Magomedov at 370, and those numbers have looked to have climbed and only seem to be climbing since. But yeah, I got it about a plus 130 roughly with the Stevens, Magomedov, and Dukinois. And then I kind of attached dogs and did my 5 piece for funds accordingly off that core. Kind of how I set up my parlays when I do them. Although parlays are kind of death in MMA, and I don't feel good about these ones. I just got a weird feeling about this card. But I do feel this is a fight Jeremy Stephens should win. Moicano, he has an improving Muay Thai offense and is deceptive. Don't let the lanky frame fool you. Moicano can crack. He's got some hard kicks. Some really good check hooks that he uses to punch in and out of the pocket, but his head is stagnant. His head is there to be a hit, and his overall movement is nothing special. He's a bit plotty, stocky, and predictable. And Jeremy Stephens knows exactly what to do with predictable guys. He does really well against more Muay Thai guys as opposed to more mobile guys like Edgar and Holloway give him problems. So if he, if Moicano does the stalking marching Muay Thai approach, I think he's gonna get countered and pressured, and Stevens is gonna bank rounds here. He's got really underrated wrestling, some of the best defense in the division. Jeremy Stephens does, so I'm not sure Moicano is gonna be able to take him down. But if it does hit the floor, that's where Moicano's best chances are gonna be. Jeremy Stephens is with his wrestling base that, again, with his wrestling being overlooked, doesn't get talked about. With that wrestling base, causes him to kind of inherently turtle to stand, which can cause back takes. And if you've seen Moicano fight, this guy takes backs very fast. That said, not as fast, not as proficient as Henan Barão. And Henan Barão is a much better wrestler statistically and opinion, as far as opinions go, than a Renato Moicano. Size difference included, folks. And Barão had some opportunities, and Jeremy Stephens beautifully used the cage. He showed a lot in that fight. That's going to show me that I think the same is going to happen here. I think that pressure is going to at least bank him 2 of the 3 rounds like it did against Henan Barão. And we may even see a late finish here. I mean, Moicano looks durable. And more important than being durable, again, don't let this lanky frame fool you. This kid is tough. Moicano has that kind of unbridled aggression. He doesn't look deterred easily, which I love. I talked about that earlier with Mendez, right? Seeing a guy get hit and being like, oh, a guy got hit. Look how much he got hit. And like, yes, it's true, getting hit's bad. I'm not going to defend that it's not bad, but everything is perspective, and it's how a guy recovers from that. And if a guy recovers from that well and does the check boxes you like to see and doesn't blink a freaking eye, well, that potential negative has a lot of silver lining positive, if you ask me. Because again, this is all perspective. But at the end of the day, my perspective is Jeremy Stephens wins this fight. All right, next is, yes, all right, the most confident, the biggest, and possibly arguable, depending on what side you're on, underdog pick is I have Robert Whittaker at plus 190. I'm not sure where the line's at now against Ronaldo Souza, who is, let's see, did it close out yet? Stay logged in, my friend. In the minus 200 range for Ronaldo Souza. Yeah, I know, again, speaking of my top 5 underdogs, shout out to Daniel Levy. I know he was already, he probably already had his research done by the time I talked to him, because on that podcast, if you listened, he was pretty sold on Robert Whittaker, and we talked And, you know, I was kind of favoring Whitaker, then I was favoring Souza going into this, to be honest. But I end up picking Whitaker. And even on that podcast, you listen to me say the biggest thing. It's not just the statistical takedown defense. I mean, excuse me. Them beers are catching up. Not just statistical takedown defense. You know, in 2014, second all-time amongst welterweights under George St. Pierre. St. Pierre's record, or I believe 2013, as far as, you know, takedown defense, moves up to middleweight by 2016. Is, you know, his last fight against Derek Brunson, December 2016 or so. He's credited as having fourth of all divisions, which means top three, because one of the people above him was an inactive fighter, being John Jones. Really impressive stuff, but statistics can be misleading. However, not in this case. And when I was talking in that top five underdog, also hearkening back to Dark Horse, you know, me and Levy were talking about in that podcast how me and him were, but Whitaker was both guys, you know, that was a big underdog score for Levy as well, and that's why it was on his, you know, Whitaker made his underdog list. We're not the only ones who had this guy as the dark horse, nor are we pretending for a second, but again, you know, these kind of narratives were in play. I'm not a Sally come lately when it comes to Robert Whitaker, that's for sure. Been a fan of this guy since I've seen him, and the first fight I saw him in was actually a loss to Stephen Wonderboy Thompson, that's right. And I still became a fan because I could see that traditional martial arts background in him. But what I was saying about the takedown defense is that takedown defense is different these days. I mean, half of it is just the footwork itself, you know. When I was talking about probably wasn't the best example, but when I was talking about Khabib Nurmagomedov versus Michael Johnson, how, you know, just moving alone and setting traps is becoming more prevalent in MMA, and just not from the takeaways from boxing as far as the setting traps aspect, but even how it translates to defending shots, that if you're moving, you're creating, and you have a really good angle awareness on the feet, you are going to help mitigate those looks to set up said shots in the first place. And Whitaker definitely has that going for him here. This is definitely one of the best guys as far as footwork goes. But not so much footwork goes. When you look at just counter-striking, wrestling, and footwork, those three checkboxes more specifically, and you go back in Jacare's record, he hasn't fought many guys like that. And most of his striking strides were, you know, the years are kind of stacking up, were about 3 or 4 years ago, and they're against guys like Okami who weren't counter strikers. In fact, the closest athletic guys who had any type of footwork or semblance of counter striking or wrestling were, yes, Yoel Romero and Luke Rockhold, people he lost to. And the most stereotypical counter striking he faced was, yes, Vitor Belfort, who he beat, but let's be honest, he didn't get the spring chicken Vitor Belfort. He kind of came, like, you know, 5 years a little late on that. Or, you know, well, actually, you know, TRT Vitor, which is 2014, 3 years late. But, yeah, you get what I'm saying here. I don't think it really counts. And Whitaker has that. And not only that, with the takedown defense, back to the original point, it's not just about sprawls these days. It's not just about fighting for underhooks or even the high-hoisting overhook, which is often overlooked with the over puns being played there. No, because what do overhooks, underhooks, and sprawls have in common, kids? Sorry, I'm not trying to be pejorative or, you know, talk down to you by saying kids. It's a habit from teaching kids karate. What do those things have in common? Well, sprawls, underhooks, and overhooks have in common is that there's a certain commitment to contact involved with all three of those. And what does commitment to contact lead to? More grappling. And what do you not want to do with Jacare? More grappling. So I'm a big fan, as you keep beating this line here, and you're going to keep hearing it, risk control. If you listen to this podcast, you know I'm a huge fan of risk control. Grab a wrist, you know, when in doubt. Because, you know, 2-on-1, you cannot advance a position or choke someone with one hand. So you're on bottom in half guard. Someone's going for a leg on the feet in a scramble for a takedown. You're on the bottom end of a takedown and turtle, and, you know, they've got a front headlock. Just that 2-on-1 risk control, or just a risk control in general, does wonders, opens up, allows you to stand, get free, breathe. Ah, Allegra, like the commercial, right? Risk control, baby. And yes, Whitaker does that, but not only does he do the risk control, because again, even if you're doing risk control or you're doing fighting for underhooks or you're sprawling, That same theory for striking applies for wrestling takedown defense, as far as if you back up in a straight line, no matter how good your defense is, if you back up in a straight line, especially where there's a barrier, whether it be a ring or especially a hard line cage where there's no give, you're going to get hit. And with takedown defense, you're going to get taken down, because Jacare, most of his takedown attempts, especially as he's gotten older, which is an argument of a loss of kind of speed and pop, but as he's gotten older especially, Jacare doesn't hit his first takedown attempt, even when he's successful and wins. It's his chains that he works from. It's the initial attempt that he uses to push guys into a fence, and then he has that unforgiving, relentless, unbridled hip suck that Damian Maia has that just seems preternatural, where they just dive in, sell out, and take your hips and base out from underneath you. So Whitaker, I don't think it's as a problem, because he circles. Not just wrist control, but circling away, breaking, you know, and circling. You know, even in the clinch when you're striking, circling, it's something that people are kind of picking up on. We saw DC, I talked about in the last breakdown how he adjusted it, how he was too stagnant, and John Jones was able to use the aforementioned wrist control and shut down DC's game, where, granted, Gustafson's not John Jones, and Gustafson wasn't emphasizing on wrist control like he should have. Nonetheless, DC made the proper adjustments when he fought in his next fight against Gustafson, and he was kind of spinning off to angles in the clinch. We see it in Muay Thai, you know, guys that are very, have that excellent roundhouse knee and straight up the middle knee dexterity. That's all fine and dandy, but the real good Muay Thai, you know, clinch strikers are guys who really get that whip where they step back with their left and kind of drag you in and use that momentum and meet you with a knee, and it makes it like three or four times more harder. If y'all done neck wrestling and knee drills and Muay Thai, if anybody's participated in even just a rudimentary class, you know what I'm talking about. Not fun on the neck, not fun on the ribs. Circling is the key to all that. You know, it crosses all throughout all the martial arts, and that's something that Whitaker does. Even when he's pinned against the fence, and when it's hard to circle, and he's pinned against the fence against a Derek Brunson, who is bigger, stronger, a more accoladed wrestler than Whitaker and Jacare. And he's completely selling out, as he did in that fight, and as he typically does. Whitaker was still able to not just circle out, and I don't want to say effortlessly with ease, because it's hard, but by God did he make it look effortless, as he not only circled out, but circled out just enough, and with the economy of motion, turned back in and uppercutted off the break, and just striking off the break, particularly, you know, in those small spaces, I think is going to serve Robert Whitaker well, and particularly his left hook. Why now? Well, no surprise, Dan. All the commentators just talk about, everybody knows he has a good left hook. Yes, yes. I know, and I could, you know, get into why, and even the commentators have already covered that. You don't need me to rehash that information here, but what I haven't heard people talk about is that Jacare is traditionally more hittable from his right side, meaning left-handed or left-footed strikes. Those are what's clocking on Jacare most. Recently, relevantly, and from even pre-UFC to his Strikeforce career when looking back then, these are the things that are hitting him the most. Couple that with, I would argue that Jacare's defense is not that great, because he keeps low hands, although he's a little better about shelling. And, you know, when he, you know, about 2013, 2014, you see him really make better efforts of going left to right with his head movement. He's doing it with low hands. And when you do that with low hands, yes, you can get hit. But he does a good job of slipping a good sense of things. But he's 37 years old. And, you know, this isn't a spring chicken anymore. And we're seeing him get more hittable. Speed and reaction time is the first thing to go with age, no matter what division you're in. So when you see a guy who's reliant on low-handed head movement, that's a problem, especially against a guy like Robert Whitaker, who only needs one to either knock you out stiff or change the course of the fight to a downhill trajectory snowball, with you, yes, being the snowball. That said, Souza gets him to the ground, and it's a done deal. I think he submits him. At the very least, wins the round. We're going to see where Robert Whitaker's jiu-jitsu is. Although the small skewed sample size shows improvements, it's not enough for any of us to say either way, right? Because there just hasn't been enough footage there. But My play is Robert Whittaker. Pardon me. Hiccups are coming strong, but I played him inside waiting for that KO prop. Ooh. Boy. Hiccup central. I'm going to try to drink more beer. That might help it, right? Does that help it?
Sure.
I don't know if that helped, but it sure was tasty. Yeah, the play's Whittaker here. He's in some parlays as well. Next fight. Keep the F away from your parlays. Michelle Waterson versus Rose Namajunas in the most tightest and hiccup-filled breakdown of the podcast. What, in my opinion, the most competitive matchup of the card. Oh, it's getting real annoying for you guys.
Oh, Jesus Christ. Stop! Jesus!
God, this is bad. But yeah, this is a tight fight. Waterson, a slight underdog. I don't blame you for liking her just because she's an underdog, but definitely keep it out of your parlays. I'm rooting for Waterson, but that's not my pick. Essentially, on the feet, it's all the karate hottie. Not all the karate hottie, but I do think she has the edge. Pause for beer. I'm going to drown you, Hiccups. Or turn into Barney Gumble from The Simpsons trying.
Hi, my name's Barney Gumble. All
right, but yeah, I think she's the better striker. I think there's going to be a speed advantage. She's the better kicking acumen. The big question is going to be, though, the jab, though. I was talking with Angelo on Cage Fighters about this. I hate that term, educated left hand, because it's like a, you know, often abused, but say what you will about Rose, she does show an educated left hand, as in, you know, she's not just long, as in, I believe it's 2-inch reach advantage, 3-inch leg or something like that, but I mean, she's longer than most of her contemporaries, but more importantly, she knows how to use that length. She will step with her jab, an accurate long jab at that, and hit her opponent, and you can see her making these reads where she has that awesome, you know, follow-up cross, but you can see her making the read that is the risk worth the reward as far as is the follow-up shot worth the potential countering back. And if Rose smells danger, she's more than happy at just scoring her jab and getting out of there. And just as awesome as she steps in, she steps just out of the pocket. And it reminds me very much of a BJ Penn, Sean Sherk. I mean, you want to see one of the best applications of jabs in, you know, MMA history, especially more so as it gets further away. It almost becomes a landmark as far as, you know, fights that change the game. Oh, sorry, I don't want to give away my man Brad's idea, but I'm not going to say any more than that. That might have been just a cheat sneak peek at the next Top 5 episode. But yes, you know, how important the jab is, and Namajunas has no problem stepping away, and when her opponent goes to follow her upon her step back, she's more than happy to step right back in and intercept them again, and then do a quicker step away, and she's really good at that, you know, and she'll variate this between check hooks, and you know, there's a lot to like there. Everybody talks about the flashy stuff from Rose, but again, flashy stuff doesn't impress me, nor do I feel it's relevant here, because I feel that was more Invicta Tough House Rose. I don't feel that this is this iteration of Rose. You know, mental intangibles or not, which, by the way, I hate speculating on that stuff, but let's be honest. There's clear mental intangibles there with Rose, and that's why Rose Namajunas is another reason why you shouldn't listen to me and keep this fight away, because she's one of the worst fighters that I have records of picking against. And amongst this is like guys like Donald Cerrone, who I think I've actually recently turned the corner with picking his fights right recently. But yeah, I mean, essentially, it's these performance people who are so psychologically based. They're so talented, they can arguably beat anybody in their division, but I don't want to say mentally limited, for lack of better words, although I understand that sounds cruel, and I don't mean it that way. It's just that their mentality and the weather of their mentality of that specific night weigh much heavier than arguably it should. So it makes, in turn, these fighters' fights hard to forecast. So if you've been burned, or if you criticize and, you know, don't want to put your money or pick Rose for that reason, I can't blame you. But I do want to think that, again, skewed sample size both ways. Watterson had a really bad skewed sample size from injury to the Invicta changeover to where she fought Manjana, then had another, you know, injury and break. And now you have Rose is the one that's coming off of the break. But I think that break's good for her, you know. She had, you know, stuff going on personal life with Pat, from what it sounds and looks like, and traveling around and going through that whole young finding yourself thing, and, you know, and whatever it is. I'm not going to pretend to know her personal life. All I know is, you know, she loves dogs, and it's my girlfriend's favorite female fighter, who, by the way, my girlfriend's favorite male fighter, you probably wouldn't guess, you know. My girlfriend's not Brazilian, by the way, you know, blonde white girl, and she loves Jacare. So there's going to be problems here at the Danton household, the fact that I picked Robert Whittaker. I haven't told her yet, because my early lean was Jacare, so I was, like, just kind of trying to, you know, get the heat off. Like, oh, yeah, I'm sure Jacare would win. And she's like, of course he's going to win, babe. Of course he's going to win. I'm like, yeah, I hear you. So, oh, I'm not looking forward to that. You know, I love her to death. She's an amazing girl. And she can hold her own, by the way, with y'all as far as MMA conversations go. But I've created a monster in that sense. That's the problem. She likes MMA too much. Everybody's like, I'm jealous. You got a girlfriend that, oh, she's educated and wants to talk MMA with you. I'm like, yeah, it's a problem now. Now she debates with me. And I tweeted this the other day. Like, we're planning our next trip to New York. And halfway through, we get into a debate on Jacare Whittaker. It was great. But yeah, she loves Rose, so at least I'm on Rose this side. And then, by the way, girlfriend has no bearing in my pick. Hopefully you can sense the humor and hyperbole in my speaking here. But yeah, we actually do fall on the same side on this one, because it comes down to the grappling. And it's hard, again, the sample size are skewed, because Michelle Watterson, that's her most improvements have been in the grappling. But that has been Rose's strongest improvements, not just the wrestling from reactive shots, which she has. And as we've seen, you know, from Angela Majana downward and upward, you can just catch a kick and kind of push Michelle Watterson over, because her aggressive and confident, she is good. She is great. But that aggressive confidence bites her in the butt. And she can get reckless and gets taken down. And even on the ground, and even when she's on the ground and on top, that same competitive spirit kind of, you know, bites her in the butt, where she overstays her welcome. And, you know, you go watch her fights back Invicta till now, you often see Watterson fending off submissions, and you don't want to do that against Rose. You know, I don't think Rose is going to submit her. Maybe in a 5-round fight, I think Rose, if a fight was going her way, then she could submit her, because then she would have the, you know, appropriate time to cook her. Like we saw with Van Zandt with a shoulder pressure and using that to get the back. But yeah, I mean, Rose Namajunas has taken down all of her UFC opponents. That's 5, and that's including Carla Esparza. And, again, I see her taking down, you know, Watterson here, and Watterson has some stuff to look out for, like arm bars from her back. And what I like about Watterson is, as slick as her arm bars is, because that's her go-to move, she's really good about using, like, failed arm bars to create scrambles, which is a very underrated thing. The problem is, when you use an arm bar to create a scramble, you're doing a back roll, and that back roll flips you back over to your base into a turtle position, which I love and I'm familiar with. But as I also state, the downfall of the turtle position is it exposes your back. And not just in the UFC, dating back to all of Rose's fights, Rose has won every fight in where she's established a back mount position. So that's something to think about, and that's something to watch for in this fight. When you look at those things on paper, and even though I want to pull my hair out with where they're potentially at with the forecasting, it's too hard to forecast, okay? Keep them out of your parlays, but if I'm being honest and looking at this on paper, I gotta go with Rose Namajunas here. Gosh, these hiccups are making me sound like I'm like, drunk over here. Like, wow, I was gonna quote Chip and Dale Rescue Rangers, because that's kind of the era of cartoon where hiccup bubbles were, you know, the semblance of how drunk a character was. And that's kind of how I feel when I'm hiccuping right now. I'm like, oh, God, I feel like one of those characters. Like, man, how drunk is Dan? Like, probably, you know, it sounds like the listeners, those bubbles are just floating. Wow. Chippendale's Rescue Rangers. If you're an old fuck like me, hashtag Protect Your Neck Podcast. Give me a shout there. Let me know you appreciate that. Or let me know you appreciate the Game of Thrones main card. Or if you have a Game of Thrones versus UFC main card, submit that. Relax, Dan. Don't plug the stuff at the end. We still have one more fight to go. I know. Before we get to that main fight, I'm going to just try to attempt to drown these hiccups because they must be annoying the shit out of you. They're annoying me. So hold on. God damn it. Oh, Jesus. Sorry, I don't know why I go to Irish accent whenever I'm in duress. Oh, Jesus. All right, Wilson Hayes as the deserved favorite. Just kidding. Demetrius Johnson has a minus 800 and rising. I imagine he'll be close to 1,000 by the crack of dawn. And Wilson Hayes, depending what house you're looking at, around the neighborhood of 6-1 odds in the comeback for an underdog. I've talked about Wilson Hayes before on this podcast, probably. Maybe not. But I'm a fan of Wilson Hayes. Probably another podcast. I'm a fan of Wilson Hayes. I actually met him, hung out with him before, grappled with him before. For a brief period of time, we shared a similar coach when my coach, Neil Melanson, was at Alliance. And would see Wilson down there when I would go down there. And also, I actually got to grapple him up here via Ricky Lindell Center. Because Neil, you know, worked with Ricky. And I forget what card. It was one of the Vegas cards up here. But, you know, I think it was Johnson Cormier 1, maybe even. And yeah, like Justin Lawrence and Wilson Hayes and stuff all came out with Neil. And we all did our grappling practice. And even though, you know, you're just going to get mauled, which, of course, I did. You know, anytime you can get just to work with a higher level and feel that level, man, it's something else. And one of Wilson's best strengths, even though he's known as a top player, he's got one of the best X guards. Like, and an X guard is essentially used from bottom to elevate. You're using, you know, kind of butterfly hooks and an X to get underneath and debase your opponent. And, you know, I always use the comparison of a chef flipping pizza dough, but that's essentially how I felt. I felt like the pizza dough and Wilson Hayes was the chef because you just try to get something going on the guy and he's just underneath elevating you, playing with you, having fun. Because he knows his skill level. But even just, you know, Hayes play mode is just like, you feel like a child. And I'm like, I got 50 pounds on you. Why are you juggling me, sir? Stop. Please stop. And no, he's super nice, though. That being said, I got Demetrius Johnson here. I'll be rooting for my boy Hayes, but I got DJ here, and I think he might even get it inside the distance. And no, that is not because Five Dimes, which is kind of strange to me. Am I missing something here, folks? Is there an error? But it's not an error. It's been on there for a couple hours now. But plus 100 again, minus 8-1 odds and counting, but plus 100 prop line. For inside the distance, that Demetrius Johnson will finish Wilson Hayes within 5 rounds. And although I don't want to see Wilson Hayes finished, you have to look at that because Wilson Hayes has been officially knocked down in 4 of his last 7. And of those 4 knockdowns, none of those include his last 2 fights where he was arguably more hurt and stunned and showed more signs of potential forecasting of defensive liabilities than any of the previously mentioned 7. And again, those weren't a part of the 4 where he actually was knocked down. So yeah, I see the lead right hand of DJ being his most common culprit here. When DJ faces southpaws or fighters who, briefly assume the southpaw position, you'll see DJ unload and kind of conduct traffic off his right hand, a la TJ Dillashaw, whether he's doing lead right hands and kind of darting with it from an orthodox stance or kind of ramming it in a jabbing fashion off of his southpaw stance, power forward. Johnson does it all in that regard. And I think that's going to be there for him as the right hands were common, amongst the statistic that I just laid as far as Hayes being dropped and or stunned. Yes, right hands were also the common culprit to fit that piece of the puzzle. So I expect to look for that there. Although I think Wilson Hayes does have a wrestling advantage, as that's probably his most clearest path to this fight, is trying to use the Dominic Cruz strategy as far as control. Because, you know, oh, he doesn't have the footwork of Cruz. Like, I get that, but Cruz didn't have the footwork of Cruz in his fight with DJ. Go back and watch it. I mean, I don't think I've asked Dominic or have heard, but you got to think something was wrong with that fight, because Dominic wasn't moving the way he was moving, and which was fine, because it was probably the smarter game plan not to outspeed Demetrius Johnson, right? It was to control him with wrestling. And I think Hayes can do that, but Hayes can kind of get aggressive too and lose position, as we've seen in fights. So it just makes me nervous that even though he's one of the best back takers and DJ does turtle to stand, that's going to be the place to look for. I'm not sure he's going to secure that. But make no doubt, not just Hayes getting the takedown, but getting the takedown and capitalizing on DJ when DJ goes to stand back up. Because, yes, well, DJ will just stand back up when he gets taken down, because, you know, I think DJ's been taken down in, like, I think 4 out of 6 of his last fights or something like that. So he's easily to be taken down, but he gets up so easy. He gets up so effortlessly, I should say. The problem is he does, you know, again, turtle out the stand. And Wilson Hayes is a really good back taker. It's just holding that position. If he holds that position, I don't think he's going to be able to submit a sober DJ. But if he can get enough cage, top, and a back mount to kind of secure 2 to 3 out of the rounds, and we have a close fight on our hands, ladies and gentlemen. Do I think that's going to happen? No. Unfortunately, I'll be rooting for it to happen, but no, I don't think it's going to happen. But if I'm making an honest argument and how Hayes can win, that's how I see it. And that's how I try to do it from both sides, no matter what the matchup is, even if it is a Bisping versus Rockhold or a Hayes versus Johnson, as I would happily be, you know, wrong about that. But with those, you know, statistics about Hayes being dropped, boy, plus money on DJ on any angle. Kind of makes sense, right? I don't think DJ's going to submit Hayes, hurt or not, because Hayes is just a beast on the ground. But strikes, boy, there's something there, in my opinion. So I do not blame you for playing that. As Johnson inside the distance plus 100, Whitaker inside the distance plus 248 at one unit is what I played. And yes, if I could read my own handwriting, I would, and I'm not. Yeah, I don't even know what the fuck I wrote there, so I'm not even going to pretend, folks. It's that late, and yeah, it's to that point. So hopefully you enjoyed the breakdown, whether it was the Game of Thrones fantasy matchmaking, the betting, or the technical analysis. You get all that here on the Protect Your Neck podcast and all of the ramblings in between. I'm pretty sure I already kind of nailed all the shout-outs from Junkie Radio to Cage Siders, everybody in between. The most important shout-out I didn't take, and that's y'all for listening. I think, you know, around UFC 209, we hit a real big jump as far as, you know, according to my analytics, and more importantly, to the responses, specifically the responses to the podcast. Y'all are digging this podcast, whether it was, you know, Robin Black, Ram Dean, Angelo Reyes, Jordan Killian, my man John Lee, Best Fight Picks, Daniel Levy, you know, these top 5 episodes, the breakdown shows, and the after party editions. For me and Brian, I'm getting a lot of good feedback. The intros, which y'all love, and the music, thank you. You know, sadly, if this shit show picks up steam and starts making some money, or even in the smallest sense, I'm not trying to make money, by the way. That's not even my goal. That's excuse me. That's not even the illusion here, which is probably the reason why any success had will be had, because I just don't give a fuck. But I know that doesn't make sense, but yeah. I appreciate the shit out of your guys' support. I've been a long-time radio listener long-time podcast fan, because I'm old like that, because there's two different iterations there. And just to kind of have my own platform, talk about fights, something I've been doing my whole life in some form or the other with martial arts, it's a fucking honor. And I have the smallest, weakest platform and followers, you know, of the mix. There's plenty better... you know, analysts, personalities, authorities, names, outlets, all of the above you who go to you, yet you're paying attention to me for some reason. I don't know why. I appreciate it. Thank you for reaching out. Thank you for sharing it with fellow enthusiasts who appreciate the game. That's probably the best thing you could do, honestly, is, you know, the likes, the retweets, the shares, which have gone up, and I have noticed, and I do appreciate. Thank you from the bottom of my freaking heart. People who know me know I'm way too nice and I'm way too much of a fucking softy. So seriously, this shit means a lot, and I'm really going to do my best to make it better. And there are certain things in the works. I am not procrastinating, Dan, although the all-nighters and certain things would tell you otherwise. It's not for lack of effort. There's a lot going on. There's a lot, you know, not so much personally, because again, that makes it sound bad. There's a lot of good things going on, but yes, on and off the books, on the scene and off the scene, there is a lot going on right now. Good things to have. I'll hopefully be able to elaborate on them sooner, but yes, I have not forgotten on the basic things. Stitcher, SoundCloud, YouTube, all coming soon. I am hearing you. Until then, I do appreciate the positive ratings and reviews on iTunes for the Protect Your Neck Club podcast. Of course, follow us at the PYN podcast. Follow me at the MM Analyst, as everything, all my future ongoings, articles and stuff like that's going to be going on there. MixedMartialAnalyst.com is where the podcasts are archived. So people complaining, you know, if it's not on your hubs as far as podcast goes and RSS feed, you know, grabbers go. I have smartphone friendly players that work for all smartphones on Mixed Martial Analyst. So in other words, you can play it from your phone and go about, close the window, close the screen, go about your day and listen to it as if it's a podcast. So that's on there. All episodes are archived on there. I'm still trying to figure out. I'm such a damn noob to the game. It's only listening like 10 of my episodes on iTunes. I'm trying to figure out how to get that so y'all can access my earlier episodes, like with John Ramdean, or my top 5 BJ Penn moments with Robin Black and all these other crazy episodes we did earlier on this year. So we're going to get those up for you. We'll definitely do an after party. I don't know if I have my man Brian with me, because these Fox cards, as a reminder, do kick off early. So it'll probably just be me with my dog and girlfriend in the background sleeping. As per usual, the after party edition. But hopefully I'll see y'all Saturday. Feel free to contribute using #, the Protect Your Neck Podcast, for any hot takes or questions you may have. And yes, top 5 themes, top 5 lists using the same #, Protect Your Neck Podcast, and all that good stuff. Until then, don't be discouraged from IPAs. Don't be discouraged from fantasy matchmaking of Game of Thrones and UFC. Do be discouraged from betting, because just be smart with your money and all that stuff. Until next time, protect your neck.